CliffCentral.com.
All right. It is Tuesday morning, CliffCentral.com, and here we are. Kicking some ass first thing in the morning, which is a nice way to wake up. We've got Mash, we've got, he's in the studio in Joburg, and we've got Rebellious Ruth, who is a regular on the show. She is one of our main commentators. She's also not at all afraid to voice her own opinion about a bunch of things. So she probably gets into a lot of trouble with friends and family and colleagues and all kinds of other people too. But that doesn't bother us. We like
it.
It's the way to be.
So Ruth and I have a couple of things in common. She is from Pretoria. She likes to entertain people, makes people laugh. She's Josh, like me. You know, I'm Josh. Sort of. And she likes to talk about philosophy, thought-provoking subjects. Her views tend to be rather more conservative than completely liberal, but she doesn't care what you do as long as you don't do harm to yourself or to animals or to others, which to me sounds like pretty much the definition of a good person, you know? I don't believe these people who walk around saying how good they are good people. I think the people who are good people are the ones who just don't do harm to other people. That's all. It's that
absolutely.
It's that simple, right?
Gotta be. Absolutely.
All right. So, Mash, how's your day going? Any crazy adventures out of the weekend? Because we know people love those. Mash always has some terrible story about something really weird that only happened to him over the weekend. Anything this weekend?
Well, Gareth, this weekend, rather on Friday. Friday actually set the tone for my whole weekend. Let's start off there.
Okay.
And on Friday, we went to the Cannabis Expo, Simpiwe, Aaron, and I. And we were like, listen, let's go see what's going on here. What's popping here in these Cannabis Expo sections of life? And we got there. It was a vibe. We bought a couple of things. And there was lots of samples. That is where the danger is. If you wanted to know where the danger is, it's about the samples. Because some of these people were so polite. They were so polite. They were like, hey, have some. And everything there was infused. We were just tasting everything. Well, I was tasting everything. And I was just, can I have another one? These people weren't even stopping me at these little booths. They were like, you could. Yeah. I'm like, is another one going to kill me? They're like, no, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. Have another one. Have 10 if you want to. Some other lady was like, listen, here's a whole biscuit. Eat the whole damn biscuit.
Oh, my God.
Some big biscuit. And I ate the biscuit. And I just want to say, I regretted it, number one. But not only for Friday evening, but until Sunday. I was baked until Sunday.
Well, yeah, you remember, I don't know if either of you do, but we did a show once where I think Ben and Flex and I can't even remember who was with us at the time. I think Sia was also there on that show where we had these guys come in and they gave us edibles, right?
Ooh.
And like, you know, like little gummy bears and things, but they obviously were full of weed. And we were a disaster but not, as you say, Mash, not for just like one day. It felt like to me that it lasted forever. It just was not going away. And I could not get out of this weird, paranoid, ugly high. And as a result, I have sworn off. And I know it's not fair, so don't lecture me. But I just never will do edibles ever again. It fucked my whole day up on that Friday and the whole weekend afterwards. You know, it's amazing because you don't feel it immediately. So you think, oh, well, obviously not working. I'll try some more. And then you do some more. Yes. And then you're basically like, a, what would you even call you, a zombie?
Yeah.
You're just like a zombie.
But this this is the thing with life. In all things, we need guidance, right? Like, I believe school wasn't the right guidance for anyone who is coming into, like, the real world.
Yes, no one tells you this at school.
Not even the weed thing. Like, you need guidance about tax. You need guidance about so many other things. And with edibles, you can't. That's the trick with them. They think, oh, it's doing nothing. Let me take like 3. The next thing, you're taking 48 hours just to recover. Mm-hmm. So Yeah, people, you want to try edibles? Slowly.
No, edibles are not for amateurs. And I'm very proud of you guys for going to the Cannabis Expo. You know, what I like about Simpiwe and Ryan and Mash is that they do all the stuff. They go to events. They're not afraid to accept an invitation. They go along. Mm-hmm. They usually all go together, and they've got each other's backs, because you never know these things, what kind of creeps are hanging around. Anyway, they get in hook, line, and sinker, and then poor Mash. So you were basically like a man down laboratory, you know, grade
guinea pig
for the whole weekend.
I was just like, y'all, I don't know how I'm even getting home.
Jesus.
I don't know. What if this cops? What is this?
Did you drive?
I was able to drive. Oof. I did actually eat. I ate a lot. Mm. And then I actually started feeling better. I think it's called munchies.
Yeah.
And I ate quite a bit, started feeling better. I had some cold drink as well. And before I knew it, I was still kind of not so well, but I'd recovered enough to drive home. So that's good. Mesh. That's a good start weekend.
Done. I mean, listen, well done. You only live once. You've got to do these things, but I think you only do that with edibles once. You won't make that mistake again.
Yes.
Because
I will not make that mistake.
Mm. It's something I will never do again. And I know people say, oh, no, but you've got to do it in the right situation with the right people. I know all of that. That makes sense. But once bitten, twice shy. It's not going to happen again. So well done. Well done for going. Well done for doing it. But, I feel sorry for you.
Not great. As you should, because mm-hmm. I was a mess. I still am kind of a mess, actually.
Hey, Ruth, I see that you are also, like a lot of people who've been emailing me lately, you're watching this Ancient Apocalypse, which is Graham Hancock's new show on Netflix. Mm. It is so good. I'm on episode 4, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm up to, like, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. And, wow. All right, so let me explain in case you don't know what this is, because you might be listening to us now going, what are these people speaking in hieroglyphs? There is a terrific show. I don't know if you know who Graham Hancock is. He's of course, an author. I read his first book, Fingerprints of the Gods, in 1995, which was – I was still at high school. And I remember reading this book because he basically explained that the pyramids weren't the tombs of three pharaohs that were built 5,000-6,000 years ago. He said that's not possible. They are – aligned to the cardinal points of the earth, north, south, east, and west. They line up perfectly with the belt of Orion, as it must have been some 12,000 years ago. That there are things about these pyramids which are just inexplicable, that would not have been part of the planning for just an elaborate tomb, even the most elaborate tomb. And he went into this book. He co-wrote Fingerprints of the Gods with a guy called Robert Bovall. I'm not sure what happened to Robert Bovall, but the two of them wrote these books, and there was a sequel to that, and they were all superb. And I remember getting into it and thinking, wow, this makes a lot of sense. The basic hypothesis of Graham Hancock's whole life's work, I hate to reduce anyone's life's work to a couple of sentences, but the idea here is that before the last global ice age, you know, when much of the planet was covered in ice and humans were really threatened as a species, there wasn't a lot of good going on among, you know, our ancestors. It was a very, very tough time. And what was particularly horrible for them is the fact that there was so little of the earth that was habitable. It was cold. The sea levels had risen by a lot, you know, a considerable amount. Not like when Al Gore told us that Venice would be underwater by now back in the 90s, and it obviously isn't. I mean, if you're going to believe Graham Hancock, then you should disregard fucking Al Gore. I mean, he can go and suck a bag of dicks. He really is. And he's the same guy who claimed to have invented the internet, remember? This was the former vice president of the United States. Bill Clinton's 2IC, who couldn't even win after Clinton was basically outed as the world's biggest pervert, you know, sticking cigars into Monica Lewinsky. Even then, Al Gore couldn't manage to pick up any kind of score and win against George W. Bush. It was embarrassing beyond belief. Anyway, but I digress. So Graham Hancock says there was an advanced human civilization that lived in the remotest antiquity beyond the last ice age, that this civilization had technology, skills in mapping, an understanding of astrology, urban planning, terraforming, the ability to build tremendous megalithic structures, and that we have lost our ability to understand anything about that time and place because modern archaeology has its timeline. Its timeline only goes back about 6,000 odd years. And before that is a big mystery where we were basically hunter-gatherers for a few hundred thousand years, doing nothing of any interest or any value or any merit. Now, it makes no sense that you can just completely wipe out any sort of evidence, and there's lots of evidence in various megalithic structures all over the earth, that would give credence to the theory that there must have been some kind of human civilization that pre-existed the modern agrarian human civilizations of Sumeria, of, you know, ancient Mesopotamia, of Egypt, and in Mesoamerica, of the Incas, the Mayas, the Aztecs, and obviously before them. But it just seems to me like this is a very good explanation for so many things that we don't understand. Monuments in Indonesia, which I didn't even know existed until this documentary. And there's compelling evidence. If you just watch this, you think, that makes a lot of sense. You know, these kind of hexagonal basalt blocks that were used to construct things. You think, well, why would anyone go to the trouble of hauling these things up a mountain and building this enormous complex that's almost like a step pyramid? Why would people have done this in Mexico? Why would people have done this in Egypt? Why is it so important for these monuments, which we cannot date because they're made of stone, and the only way we know how to date things is with carbon dating. Carbon dating is used on organic material. So you can find, you know, something that was once alive, and you can date the amount of carbon-14, I think it is the isotope, that remains in that that sample over time. And you can figure out roughly within, you know, an area of about 100 to 500 years how old something is. And it's not the best, but it's probably one of the most accurate ways that we can identify the age of a sample. Of course, that doesn't help you with stone, because stone is not alive, and you can't date something that doesn't have carbon in it with carbon-14 dating. So yeah. All of this is just fascinating, and Graham Hancock has never given up, despite being mocked and ridiculed and denigrated by modern archaeologists who've just said, this guy is a crackpot, he's a nutcase, he's not to be taken seriously. And done everything they could to devalue his work and to destroy his reputation. So I love this show. It's amazing.
He's a modern day Da Vinci, actually, if you think about it.
You think?
In a way. Not exactly. Yep. But I mean, Da Vinci was also ridiculed, head up for heresy, if I think, at one stage, no?
I think maybe that's certainly true for Galileo, who was, you know, he had the cheek to say that the sun is at the center of our solar system and not the earth, and that the Catholic Church went, oh, burn him at the stake. And luckily they didn't burn him because he recanted. He said, oh, no, I was obviously wrong. The Church is right. Just please don't burn me, which is what any sensible person would do. But it is very, very interesting work. And I don't think we've even scratched the surface of what there is in our remotest antiquity.
So on this show, Gareth, Graham is basically explaining or trying to actually figure out how exactly these ancient civilizations were living and how these ancient buildings were built is basically what I'm picking up.
He's trying to explain. I mean, for example, Mash, there are certain like blocks of solid rock that weigh up to 12, 15 tons that could not be moved. You would have trouble moving them even today with a crane. Certainly at those heights and at those distances, some of these, you know, stones were mined hundreds of kilometers from where they eventually were put into these monuments. And nobody can explain how they did it. And people are more than satisfied in modern archaeology to go, yeah, it's just a tomb. Yeah, they just built this to bury some king. which is insane. I mean, there's just no reason. There's never been a body found. There's no explanation for how that could possibly be true. It was just like the most simple explanation that ancient Egyptologists, not even ancient, just Egyptologists from about the 1920s could come up with. And remember, we're discovering new things about human history every single day.
So we're not. So are we going to ignore that History Channel show about ancient civilizations and how they used to actually collaborate with aliens in building these?
Yeah.
We're going to.
Well, Corona's Boring says polygonal masonry, which is a kind of building technique, is fascinating. And the term you're deliberately avoiding is pre-diluvian. No, I think you there's no such thing as pre. You mean antediluvian, A-N-T-E. That's the term that you're looking for, Corona's Boring. Both of these, each of these cultures have a flood legend. Now, that's true. So antediluvian means before the flood. And all of the cultures in the world, going back as far as we can tell, every single culture on Earth, from the ancient Peruvians to the ancient Chinese to the Turkish to the Greeks to the Romans to the Egyptians, every one of them has this story, and it's, you know, it's part of what eventually ended up in the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim holy books. There was a flood. God was angry, decided to wipe the slate clean, start again, but there were a few survivors, and that those survivors were the people who had been part of this advanced civilization, who then taught civilization to those primitive creatures that were our ancestors. So it's scary because it means that there isn't this straight line of history. You know, that history is this continuous straight line of improvement. It really isn't. And you can even, in recent history, see that that's not true. If you look back at the kind of development and growth and building and architecture and engineering that the ancient Greeks and Romans were up to about 2,000 years ago, and then you look at how everything descended into chaos in Europe during the Dark Ages, where nothing bigger than a small church was built until at least, you know, 1100 AD, and then they start building much more impressive things again. So for some unbelievable, inexplicable reason, there's this huge gap somewhere between about AD, you know, 300 and 1100, where humans in Europe just were very backward again, where, of course, there were ideas, there was a lot of religious stuff going on, but there weren't any of the great achievements of classical Greek and Roman history. And you could see that that is possible on a much longer span of time. So this is fascinating stuff. It really is amazing. It is similar to what Charles Berlitz did in the Bermuda Triangle, says Psilocybe. I'm not familiar with that, but maybe you can fill us in. Yes. While the rocks do date the fossils date the rocks more accurately. That's true if you can find fossils around them. And so many of these places are devoid of human remains. In other words, there are no human. There's no reason why, because if they were settlements, they should have had people around them, right? People would have been buried there or whatever. I mean, this one in Turkey was deliberately covered up. People went and took enormous trouble to bury it and to hide it away so that one day it would be discovered perfectly in the state that it's in now. You've got to ask yourself why the hell that would happen. Sunmarie says, ancient apocalypse poses such an interesting theory. My hubby and I have been going down that rabbit hole for the past week. Yeah. They're looking, says Aiden, at sound frequencies as the answer to how they move those large stones. Hmm. Yes, Mash?
The biggest question is always, where did these civilizations disappear to? There is no remains of any civilization. There's no, their houses are gone. Their skeletal remains. There is nothing. Where did they all disappear to?
Well, George even says, George Meany, imagine losing computers and the internet today and then try to explain it or recreate it when most of the planet dies. You see, we always think that there's going to be evidence that we existed. But if you imagine an enormous Earth event, an asteroid smashes into the Earth, like, you know, the one that killed the dinosaurs, for example, that reduced so much of the planet to rubble and ash and fire that whatever was alive, with the tiny exception of only a few places which managed to continue to exist. I mean, most of the species that were alive on planet Earth when that asteroid hit with the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous era, that asteroid wiped out all evidence of, you know, civilizations or animal species or any. We're only discovering them now because so many of them fell into mud, and that mud eventually became rock, and then we've cracked open a few of those rocks and discovered some of these dinosaurs. But human beings, look at all the stuff that we think we consider civilization. Like, if I just think about it, all these books, if there was an asteroid that plunged into Earth, these would all be incinerated. My house would be reduced to rubble. There would not be one brick piled upon another. All the photographs, all the recordings, all of the stuff, even the stuff in the cloud, would be wiped out because those servers would be wiped out. There would be nothing left to prove that I had existed here if something like that had to happen. Similarly, if we had an enormous, you know, global-scale flood, there would be places, sure, that were high enough that would be able to survive, but everything else would be destroyed, and that would include much of what we consider the most advanced parts of the planet. You know, there are very few cities on Earth that are not on a major waterway, either a harbor or a river or something. And those would all be taken out in a situation of flooding like that. So you have to think, if this, on the scale of, you know, 10 to 12,000 years, it's very easy to wipe out entire civilizations and all the evidence of them. So how would you, if you were forced to try and send a message to people in 10,000 years from now, what would you do to kind of let them know that you'd existed?
There's nothing you can do. And you know, Gareth, 10,000, 12,000 years is such a tiny sliver in the timeline of the Earth. It's literally like a second in the timeline of the Earth. Mm-hmm. So there's literally nothing you can do to send a message.
Absolutely right. I mean, you know, they say that human beings, if you took the life of the planet Earth, which is 4 billion years, and you took a clock, you know, one of those old round-faced clocks, 12 o'clock at the top and 6 o'clock at the bottom, all of the time from 0000 right the way up to 2359 and 40 seconds, no humans. No humans. We're only there for the last 20 seconds of the entire clock's time, to give you an idea of how long Earth has been around before humans came and made any kind of move on it. So that's interesting. You're right.
We're a very young species.
Tiny. Mm-hmm. We're so unimportant. This is what I said yesterday about climate change and global warming. The planet will be fine. The planet will continue to exist whether we're on it or not. And new species will come up and exist, because life is very, very difficult to completely wipe out, as we've learned from prehistory. It would be interesting to see how all of this changes over time, and what people might say about our civilization now in 100, 200, 300, let alone 1,000 years. If we're lucky enough to last for 10,000 years, which I don't know if we can, there's so much that can go wrong. If we last for 10,000 years, what will they say about the people who are alive in the year 2022?
That's a good question. That's a good question. We'd like to find out one day. If
we were savages.
They would. They'd say
we were these Neanderthal savages who just plundered, killed, and destroyed everything that, you know, has any worth.
Yeah.
They used to have an app called Twitter where they'll just talk crap. Yeah. And they just share their thoughts that nobody cared about.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody was listening to anyone else. You know,
everybody wanted to talk. Mm.
I still think it would be really amazing if they can discover even more compelling evidence that would make it impossible for people to just wipe out Graham Hancock's theories. You know, if someone had to find something that was irrefutable, and I don't know what that might be, maybe some piece of ancient technology that we can't, and there are things that they've dug up, things that they can't explain properly, machines of a kind. And if we could find out, you know, a little bit more about that time, 10,000, 12,000 years ago, I think that then it would be very, very difficult for conventional archaeologists to say, ah, don't worry about that. It's not a big deal.
Mm. But Gareth, it also goes back to our current civilization. 10,000 years from now, if our civilization no longer exists on this planet, and whatever species exists by then, whether it is human or not, they're also going to see maybe the remains of our buildings, the remains of the Empire State Building.
If you've ever, there's been a really interesting documentary, I forget the name of it, but if New York City had to be, if all the humans in New York had to die, and you can even see this here in South Africa, if you look at a plot of land in a city or a town where there's a house and people move out of the house and eventually it's condemned and, you know, you get homeless people moving in, but the weeds start growing and the trees start growing and the grass starts, everything gets out of control. Within a couple of months, that property is overrun with plants and it's very hard to see the original building. And then over an even longer period of time, like a few decades, the plants start destroying the buildings. They break open the concrete, they destroy the foundations, the roots grow through the building itself. And ultimately, it's pulverized. If you go there in 100, 200 years, there's nothing left. You would struggle to figure out that there had been a house there. And over hundreds of years, you know, 500, 600 years, you're not going to find very much evidence unless you are painstakingly going through, you know, archaeological remains and finding little bits of pottery or whatever else it is and saying, oh, well, look, there must have been humans living here once, but they must have been so primitive. Meanwhile, you had air conditioning and you had internet and you had, you know, UPSs and solar power. They wouldn't know because everything would be so disintegrated that within a couple of hundred years that you wouldn't be able to tell that there'd been a house that humans had lived in some kind of civilized way.
Yes. I mean, we'll also see documentaries in about 100 years, 200 years, talking about how they used to have devices.
Yeah.
Little devices that they used to communicate. They used to communicate on them.
So often,
they didn't even talk to each other because they were just talking to each other through these devices. And they'll be like, wow, did they click when they communicated? And the way we talk about ancient civilizations now is how they'll be talking about us.
I mean, how do we know that they didn't have something like this? There wouldn't be any way to make a phone last for thousands of years. There's no way you could do that. It would not last.
My phone's 2 years old and it's already slowing down and falling apart.
Exactly.
So that's a great way of that's a great way of actually viewing it. It won't last.
So what do you think of the show, Ruth?
So I think it's amazing how he sort of just lifts the sort of, if you picture a head and he just lifts the top off to say these archaeologists they have to think bigger, they have to, and they won't acknowledge him for any of it.
No.
I think there's one guy.
Oh.
And the truth is that he's basically said that these structures have such a connection with the astrological heavens,
mm-hmm.
and there's a reason, and there was definite calculation, and there was definite purpose.
Yeah.
And he talks about a lot of what they saw dragons were, which were meteors, comets, and just how that they were terrified, obviously, because obviously these things happened, that they would have these showers, these collisions, perhaps on Earth, maybe not to such a large scale as wiping out the dinosaurs, but they definitely impacted on, excuse the pun, on the Earth as they knew it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, absolutely. Listen, doesn't it strike you as weird that this flood myth is part of every civilization's mythology? That every civilization on Earth has some idea.
I think it's actually fantastic.
Well, it shows you that we're all linked, right, and that that there's this memory. Remember, if you want to talk about something that humans need to remember for hundreds, if not thousands of years, you either put it into music, dance, poetry, or mythology. Those are the only things that you can do.
Mm.
in order to preserve something. Yeah. I mean, you can carve things on stone too, but as we've just discussed, sometimes that doesn't stay where it is. It gets buried under sand, gets lost, it gets washed away. But if people transmute stories through generations by song, by dance, we know that, you know, on our continent in Africa, our history is told orally. It's told by the old people who will gather around, tell the young people the story of where they come from, tell the young people what their culture is all about, explain to them where their language and their music and their stories all come from. And that's the way that it has been carried down for at least hundreds of years and maybe a lot more. So if in our deepest recesses of memory, all civilizations have this flood thing going on, there must be something to it. There must be something about that that we were like, oh my God, this is the closest we've ever come to becoming extinct. Because that would remain in the story, right? That we, no one's going to take that out of the story. It's the main climax. It's like the movie Apocalypse, but you leave out the asteroid, you know?
Yes, 100%. And, sorry, Doug here says that Tupperware will survive.
There are some things that will survive forever, right? But they're even discovering now that there are bacteria that can destroy plastic. So, again, this might not be an explanation for, you know, any kind of ancient civilization that did invent plastic. Who knows that we aren't the first things that have discovered plastic. I mean, plastic's just a carbon chain of a certain length.
Yeah.
And these things can form naturally. That's how we discovered plastics. Mm-hmm. But who's to say that there wasn't stuff like that? And you're telling me that plastic isn't going to wear down over 10,000 years? Show me a plastic that will survive that. There aren't stones that will last 10,000 years. Nonsense. Mm-hmm. So
Gareth, I'm recording you, and I'm sending you to the paper straw people. I'm sending this clip to the paper straw people to tell them to listen up. Enough is enough.
Right, exactly.
But yeah.
So I think the answers will lie also on our DNA, on our mitochondrial DNA one day. They'll be able to figure out exactly, like they're doing it already now with all these genealogy tests.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's much more to it, much more to it that we'll be able to know in 200-300 years' time of exactly what goes on.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is sort of a bit of a blueprint to our genetic history is to look at our DNA. It's not even completely well understood now. There's a lot of about our genetic code that is completely misunderstood. We're not sure what that supposed junk DNA is. I just want to throw in this comment because it came in from somebody earlier about another story that's in the news, which is worth talking about. Tracy says, Elizabeth Holmes, the Theranos fraudster, got 11 years in jail. That story is insane.
Yes.
So either of you know this story?
I know the story
Go ahead, Mash.
Elizabeth Holmes is a damn nutcase. Following this story for quite some time. I even listened to the podcast about it.
Yes.
I've got the name of the podcast. It's Holmes something. But
uh-huh.
So Elizabeth Holmes dropped out of, I think, was it Washington Stanford, where she was studying. I can't remember exactly what she was studying. I don't have the details in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
But she started a company that claimed to be able to run a whole sleuth of tests, blood tests,
yeah,
with just a fingerprint. Just a fingerprint.
Yes.
So just one drop of blood was all it took to run a whole sleuth of tests, from HIV tests and a whole range of other tests. And people bought into this. People actually believed in her vision. And she managed to convince many millionaires and multi-billionaires to invest in this.
Well, she raised something like $700 million from venture capitalists and private investors. And by the way, she started this when she was 19 years old?
When she was about 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And the whole time, some of her professors there at Stanford, just after she dropped out, were like, this is not possible. What do you mean? This is not possible. But she kept pushing. And the more she pushed, the more people were like, wow, it's a story of strength and inspiration because she was able to do it. And I was like, no, she wasn't. She's just lying to everyone about something that doesn't exist, a product that never existed and never will exist. And the more she lied, the more people bought into it. She raised millions and millions. In fact, I think she reached a billion at some point.
Well, she personally was worth like $4.5 billion at her height. And now she's worth virtually nothing. In fact, she's going to jail, obviously. Four counts. She's been found guilty of four counts of fraud and conspiracy. In January of 2022, the case started, and it lasted until just the other day. And now she's going for 11 years and 3 months to prison. Yeah, you've explained that perfectly, Mash. What a nutcase. But it shows you again how human beings are so desperate for easy answers to complicated questions. We would rather take this simple explanation, even if it's inaccurate, than actually go to the trouble of trying to figure it out ourselves.
Nobody ever took the initiative. Oh, the podcast I listened to is called The Dropout. It explains it very well.
Very good.
It also comes with accounts of some of the people who actually used the Theranos machine and actually got blood tests done through it. One woman thought she was HIV positive for like 2 weeks because of this damn machine. And it was giving people negative results. People are thinking they have illnesses and diseases they never had.
Well,
and another thing, was called the, I forgot the name of the actual unit. Do you remember the name of the unit, Gareth?
No, but you called
it a name.
You called it the Theranos machine, and that's good enough for me. I don't know much more than what you've already said.
The Edison.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, listen, this is just proof again that human beings will fall for a whole lot of shit if it sounds too good to be true. I mean, Ruth, if someone came to you, Mash, if someone came to either of you and said, hey, listen, all I need is one drop of blood and I'll just identify everything that could possibly go wrong with you. It'll tell you whether or not you're going to get cancer. It'll tell you whether or not you have to be careful of high blood pressure. We'll tell you all about just the one drop of blood and we'll figure everything out because we've got this incredible machine. And, you know, the more complicated these things look, the more people go, well, it must be true. It's like human beings. If they take a pill, they start believing they're getting better, even if it's just, what do they call it? God, I always forget this word. What's the word for something?
Placebo.
Placebo. Thank you very much. A placebo. You give people a placebo. They don't know that it doesn't work, but they start believing it, and guess what? They get better. Human beings are so convinced by nonsense, and we're so easily persuaded by kind of rubbish arguments a lot of the time that nobody asks hard questions of these things. This woman could quite easily have still been running this business. She could have been doing thousands of tests in inverted commas, every day and charging people a fortune for them and then giving them these health. I mean, I've got a report here in the drawer that they did on my DNA about 8 years ago. All right. And it was this long and complicated process where they took some DNA on a cotton swab from the inside of my mouth. And then they gave me a whole breakdown of what that means. Now, a lot of it may be absolutely fantastic. It might be absolutely accurate. It might give a very good idea of what I can deduce and find out about my own physical well-being. But some of it is probably complete bullshit. And who's to say what part is what? And they did it for me for free, but can you imagine if Elizabeth Holmes had charged people $1,000 for each of these tests and had made an absolute killing, which she was doing at the time, mostly out of investors and venture capitalists. And frankly, if you're an investor or venture capitalist and you get taken because you haven't done the research, too bad. You kind of deserve that as well.
Too bad.
Yeah, too bad. So I feel sorry for them, but not that much. If you know what I mean. And human beings are like, oh no, well, this sounds too good to be true, therefore it must be true.
That's what I always say. If it sounds too good to be true, it is.
Mash, I'm so glad you've learned that lesson, young my boy. So good. I'm still learning it.
Oh, Ruth, I'm just about to see it.
You know, people want to be led. I mean, just with the whole lockdown. I mean, example. It was yesterday. The lockdown.
Yeah.
We all just, well, not all, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm an exception.
Yes. Yeah.
But people want to be led, literally, like some strange fetish where they dress up with bridles and reins and be led around the paddock.
Yeah.
Go figure.
You know, we talk about what civilizations will say about us in the future, but I guarantee you one thing they'll do is look back at this 2020 to 22, and they'll go, what the fuck is wrong with those people? Those must have been some of the dumbest people that ever walked the earth. I'm surprised they weren't on all fours. They just put on, they all put on masks because the government told them to. They all started like distancing themselves from each other. They shut down the shops. What are they? Were they fucking insane? I promise you, people look
at them.
They stopped selling alcohol in South Africa. They told them not to wear open shoes or buy Woolworths chickens. People will look back and go, those must have been the most stupid people since primitive man to have made any rules for themselves. So
the dumb-dumbs.
I'm with you, Ruth. Not all of us did that, but a lot of people did, and they fell for it. I mean, you see these people still. I saw two people over the weekend who were wearing masks, and I thought, look, maybe they're real germ phobes, okay? And that's entirely possible. Mm. There were always people before COVID who wore masks as well, but they were rare. And I didn't really take them too seriously or worry about them too much. So they might be those kind of people. But if they're people who are still afraid of COVID, I mean, there's still people, believe it or not, who are talking about COVID like it's important.
Well, clearly they have nothing more interesting going on.
But there's interesting stuff in the news.
Yeah. What do you got?
Yiannis Vallis, the man who...
Okay, do you want to talk about him? You want to talk about Yiannis Vallis?
No, well, we had I think well done for actually considering that he should get parole. I know I'm controversial in saying so.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I think he was part of a military directive. At the end of the day, we were in a war. And look, killing is awful, but at the end of the day, man's literally on his last legs. Why not let him go?
Let's give everybody the context here, because not a lot of people still care about Yiannis Vallis. Yiannis Vallis is the guy who pulled the trigger on Chris Hani. Chris Hani was, of course, a very important member of the South African Communist Party. Many touted him to be a future leader of the ANC, a potential president, if not cabinet minister, but someone who was very, very important during that transition period in this country's history. He obviously is a murderer. He spent, what is it now, how many years in jail? Must be close to 20 years, either way.
20 years.
They've basically said at various levels, we have parole boards. He should never be released on parole. He's done 20 years, which is more than most people in South Africa ever do for any crime. All of the crimes have like a maximum sentence of like 20 years, unless you've murdered 500 people, in which case they add more and more years to your sentence, right? And obviously, Chris Hani, we can't bring him back. And Yiannis Vallis has demonstrated time and time again that he has learned his lesson. I mean, I've said it before on this show that South African jail is probably one of the worst places you could end up in. It's no fun at all. And I'm not a fan of Yiannis Vallis. I don't believe that any, right-wing lunatic actor who picks up a gun and goes and takes out someone who they disagree with or who they think is a threat. That's not the kind of thing that we should ever defend in South Africa. But the Justice Minister says it's time. A South African Communist Party leader, Chris Hani's killer, Yiannis Vallis, should be released on parole. Apparently, the Constitutional Court has actually been the one to make the decision. Apparently, the Constitutional Court is now going to, in their unanimous judgment, which was penned by the Chief Justice, agree, finding that the minister's decision, that's Ronald Lamola, was irrational, and order the minister to place Vallis on parole. So that means he's going to be put on parole. That doesn't mean he's going to be a free man. It means that he'll be allowed out. He'll be, under house arrest. He's going to have who even knows what this guy looks like? The last picture we have of him is back in 1997 when he was at a hearing in the Pretoria City Hall, shortly before he was sentenced. That's the last time we've seen this guy. I don't know if there's anybody who's, had an interview with him or whether he's spoken to anybody at all. But this is pretty much all we know about Yiannis Vallis. He was born in Poland, and he was an immigrant to South Africa, as far as I can recall. And he worked with, what was her name? Darby Lewis, Clive Darby Lewis and his wife, to plot the assassination of Chris Hani. But, you know, do you think that someone should be released on parole no matter what they did, no matter how horrible, no matter how symbolic their egregious crimes might be? Do you think they should be let out eventually?
Yeah, it's a hard call, huh? It's such
That's a hard call. It depends on crime.
Yeah, apparently...
I still think pedophiles should be...
Yes? Go on.
Mm-mm. No, read the comments, it's fine.
No, no, so Chris Hani's widow, who's Limpo Hani, she has lashed out at the judge, Judge Zondo, over this. She basically said that he's failed the country, and, you know, he's obviously trying to, the judge is trying to explain this in legal terms, but she said she struggled to contain her emotions. Chief Justice Zondo has failed this country completely, and I'm not going to apologize. She feels the trauma she and her family were put through is not given due consideration by the Constitutional Court. The country is finished. Where in this country a foreign white can come into South Africa and kill my husband? She said she was shocked by Monday's judgment. It is diabolical, totally diabolical. I've never seen anything like this. And she then said, we are in shit. So, look, I think this is Limpo Hani's story. She can't, obviously, this is what makes her important and noteworthy, and nobody's asking her about other things that are going on in her life. She's been bearing this this terrible this is her identity in some ways for what 20 odd years, 22 years, 27 years. Mm-hmm. So I really think that this isn't emotional. You can't get emotional. If we live in a society that regards sentences as ending, then we need to release people once those sentences end. If we don't believe in that, then keep it going. Let's turn our attention to Jaco Voigt, who's coming in this morning to do his show. He is the CEO of Catalytic. Welcome, Jaco. You've met Ruth and Mash before. How are you?
Good morning. Well, and everybody?
Lucky to see you.
Lucky, yeah, lucky. Good.
Have you been watching Ancient Apocalypse?
I have not. I've been listening to you guys this morning, and it's sounded like you're quite philosophical about what we're doing here and where we're going.
Well, so I mean, interesting. Isn't it interesting? Don't you think that there's possibly another explanation for what happened in human prehistory?
Well, I was actually saying to my wife yesterday, I read somebody posted on Twitter, what if mycelium was basically feeding humans so that they can feed on us later when we die. So it was interesting.
Yeah.
So who knows what we're doing here?
Maybe we're just fuel for the mushrooms.
Maybe we're just here for the mushrooms. I know there's some people that I'm sure that is just here for the mushrooms.
Wow.
Absolutely.
So Jaco, didn't you just go and do some race somewhere? Did you go to Mossel Bay? What was that thing?
Yeah, there's a place in between Oudtshoorn and Prince Albert. We went for 4 days to go and run 80 kilometers in a mountain there.
That is properly insane. I went to my doctor yesterday. He does these half Ironmans, and he did a full Ironman a couple of years ago. And you and your wife do these crazy 80 kilometer things now. Just explain exactly what it is, because you just talk about it like it's not a big deal. But if I had to do 2 kilometers, I'd probably die.
No, look, what we're doing is it's still baby stuff. There's guys that run 160 kilometers, so we're doing baby stuff. We did.
Yeah.
Oops.
Oh, is that us? Let me just check if I remove Jaco here and I put him back on. Very strange.
I look at these people and wonder who's chasing them. Like, do they have imaginary? Why do you torture yourself?
Who are you running from?
Exactly. All right, while we're trying to get Jaco back on, because we've still got a few minutes to talk to him, other stories in the news this morning. The last time Jacob Zuma went to jail, Twitter was moderated. This time, not so much. there are a lot of stories at the moment that are coming out about Twitter and how it's changed under Elon Musk, and, you know, Donald Trump is back on and this has got people crazy. But in mid-2021, Jacob Zuma went to jail and deadly riots spread through KZN and Gauteng. On Monday, the Supreme Court of Appeal ruled that Zuma should return to jail, though possibly only after he appeals to the Constitutional Court. And obviously things have changed now. The government has recognized it, and it started to fix intelligence and policing failures that allowed violence and destruction to spread during those riots. Political power has shifted, such as the door opening on President Cyril Ramaphosa stepping aside if he's charged with a crime, and Elon Musk has gutted Twitter. So people are nervous. What does this mean? I don't think it means very much at all, but that's just me. We'll have to see what happens. Hey, Yaku, sorry, we lost you. I think it was our fault.
No, it was my fault. Sorry, the slow shedding. You know what they say, the mechanic's car is always in the shop, so my internet gave way, you know.
All right, well, let's talk about the internet, because this is what you and your company do. It's part of the reason that you have your own podcast where you talk about all kinds of interesting stuff to do with cybersecurity, and you've had some amazing guests this year. What is the largest, in your opinion, cybersecurity threat in the world right now? Where do you think that threat's coming from?
Well, last week when you and I were chatting about how everybody is saying they're so tired after the year and everybody is just in holiday mode now, I think the biggest threat for everyday businesses at this very point in time is holiday. You know, it's holidays coming up. You know, everybody is a lot more relaxed. People tend to go and leave, so there's less people in the office, and that makes us less vigilant. And then obviously, if you're going away on holiday and you're closing up shop, that IT system's, it still sits there. It's also alive. And it sits there and it's possibly at your office. And who's looking at it? You know, so I think holiday at this point, at this time of the year, is probably the biggest security risk that there can be.
So you've got to be extra vigilant now. Which country in the world has the best cybersecurity?
If I had to take a guess off the cuff, I'd probably say Israel. You know, the technology that they churn out is really, really amazing. I mean, they obviously collaborate a lot with the US, but I mean, Israel is, from a technology and from a security perspective, is I think it's top notch. I think in South Africa, you know, we tend to be, I think we're getting there, but we're not always as vigilant and aware of what can go wrong as other people in the world. I think we're getting there. You know, it's a continuous getting the message out there and getting people to understand, because the problem with it is when similar, you know, we always talk about this, similar to your house, whenever you want to or have to invest in security, you know, it's going to cost money, you know. So what's the value of a security investment or upgrading your security? Well, the value is until something goes wrong, then you wasted money. When something goes wrong, then the money was well spent, you know. So
right.
It's always difficult to quantify that until something happens.
So,
Yaku.
Go ahead, Mash.
Yes.
All right. Yaku, one of the biggest fears when it comes to cybersecurity for most companies is the PR of it, you know, especially when there's a hack. The PR of it is the most terrifying thing, because your customers or your clients knowing that their personal information could possibly be in someone else's hands from your servers is one of the most terrifying things for any business owner. And I wanted to find out, is it compulsory for businesses to actually communicate with their client base and tell them that, listen, guys, we've been hacked? Or can businesses just keep quiet and just shush about it? Is it a must for them to actually communicate that? And I'll also explain why I'm asking that, but please just answer first.
Wow, that's not an easy question. I think, Amash, I think if you look at with Poppy that's in play now, I think when an incident happens, you know, you've got to go at least to the relevant authorities in your industry and go and report it. I think you have to try and get ahead of something when it happens. Let's be honest, you know, you've got customers, employees, suppliers. How can you keep something like that a secret? I don't think there's necessarily a law or a regulation that compels an organization to go to the public and say, listen, this happened. But I think just being wise about it, because you can't hide it. You know, somewhere somebody's going to know about it. And then if you didn't say anything, then you know, how can you talk your way out of that thing?
Yes. I was asking because my hosting provider, actually, I think they got hacked. And I'm saying this because I've been getting emails from a whole different domain with, like, Russian RU, what's it called, subdomains and so forth. And I actually asked them, I was like, are you guys hacked? Because I'm getting emails from foreign emails, email addresses, with my customer number and my details there. And it's saying, listen, click this link to renew this or renew that, renew this email or that domain and so forth and so on. And I'm like, hey, bro, something's wrong. And I've been getting these for like the past 2 weeks and I contacted them. They're like, no, don't worry.
Bro, they won't admit.
Like,
they
got my information somehow.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. So they won't admit that they've been hacked.
Yeah, sir.
They won't.
Yeah, so Maj, I think you know that's it's actually so in a podcast that I had last week where we spoke about email and stuff like that, you know, so you can be a email or an internet service provider, and there's people can try and you know hack you or fish or whatever. But it's not to say that it came from that service provider. You know, it can be that that details were obtained elsewhere. But in saying that, I think, you know, when you blatantly go and ask a service provider, listen, were you hacked because of this and this and this, I think people will out of the nature of our industry, people will be apprehensive and maybe maybe try and talk around it if you talk about it. I have this talk often or discussion often of, for me specifically, post this pandemic, you know, customers tend to be perpetually dissatisfied and almost a little bit distrustful of any service providers. So post pandemic, you know, all of us are having a hard time. You know, customers just want more, and they tend to be more unreasonable. So it's not an easy job as it used to be, you know.
Yeah, I interviewed a guy yesterday who was the former COO of Lego. And he was fascinating to talk to. And one of the things he said is that the customer is not always right. And it takes a brave person in business to be able to accept that their customer might be wrong. And sometimes you have to educate people, and especially when they're not expert in a certain area, they're asking questions, and they just don't know what the answers should be. And this is really why we like to get Yaku on, because there's so many things around this that we don't consider on a day-to-day basis. So, Yaku, it's obviously... it's December, it's the holidays, there are lots of things that are not on people's mind. Your IT in your office, your cybersecurity, all of that stuff. People are also betting on the World Cup at the moment. Sports betting has gone through the roof in the last couple of days. So are there things that you could tell us we should do? Like, if you leave your house, should you switch off your router? Should you disable all of that stuff?
Well, so Gareth, that's interesting. I think we know we're going into this increased form of load shedding, and electronics as a by nature doesn't like on and off right. All of the time. So I think switching it off, you know, is neither here nor there. I think what's important is if you have a small business, and coming back to data is the new gold, if you want to call it that, or maybe the old gold now already. Is how secure is that server sitting in your office? Who's looking at it, et cetera, et cetera? You know, when you were talking about earlier about you know, if our civilization had to disappear, you know, there'd be no evidence of the cloud and all that type of stuff. I wanted to say, you know, our data center that we operate is bomb-proof. So, you know, that's probably the place where remnants of our civilization will be found. So for me, it's where do you store it? How you know, how secure it is, and is somebody looking at it? You know, right. So I think one of the key things that we always try and do is try and monitor services. You know, if you can monitor stuff, then you can manage it. If nobody's looking at it, then it's a problem.
Well, that's unfortunately all we've got time for, but you can hear Yaku doing his own show a little bit later today, and always the most interesting people from all over the world who are at the top of their game in cybersecurity, as is Yaku Voigt. It's always good to see you, dude, and thank you very much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you very much. I'll see you later.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, we've got lots still to get to, and Ruth will stick around. She's with us until Blind History, which is at 7:30. Don't go anywhere. That's all on the way. CliffCentral.com. It is Tuesday, and we're getting very, very close to the end of November. Tick tock. CliffCentral.com.